Hey, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And I realized, damn, I've had some interviews that I should have put out sooner. This is lazy by me. They're there. They're waiting to be sent out. And I think I'm giving the podcast maybe too long before the next one. This interview that you're going to hear with Andrea Sartori, who is one of the big characters in Valpolicella and Verona. Not only is he a winery owner, a very famous winery, Sartori di Verona, which he was named president of the company in 2000. He's also like president of the regional consorio, and I'm sure I mispronounced that. But basically, he is a huge deal in Verona. So the land of Valpolicella and Rapasso and Amarone and all that kind of stuff. Like, this guy is a huge deal, both politically, in terms of the region, in terms of, you know, the rules that go on in that area, and just as a winemaker. And he makes really good wine. I was at a winemaker dinner with him ages ago. Like, it was like game four or five of the NBA finals between, obviously, the Raptors and Golden State. And I actually had to leave during at the end of the dinner because I had to go home and work for, you know, for TSN Radio. Because if I'd stayed for the whole night, you know, my recollection of the game would have been a little bit hazy, to say the least. As I've said before, the first wine that I fell in love with was Rapasso-style, you know, Italian wine from Valpolicella. So, you know, this was a wine event I was not going to miss. Before I get into it, it's been a while since I've given a random wine recommendation. So I'm going to do that, but I'm not going to go with the Valpolicella because I've done, you know, Rapassos in the past. And as I record this, it's a Monday night. It's September 23rd. This will be out in a couple days. I don't feel like drinking an Amarone. You know, if you're on your own on a Monday, Amarone might not be the best choice. Amarone is, that's a Friday. That's a weekend wine. That's a, you know, not the first bottle you have. Maybe the second, and be careful what you pair it with because it's a big, powerful wine, you know, high body, high alcohol. When done well, it's delicious. When done poorly, it just destroys your senses, which might seem weird. It's like, wait, I spent $47 on this bottle of wine and I can't taste my steak anymore. Yeah, it can happen. So I'm actually going to go in a different direction. A wine that I'm drinking tonight, I bought for a barbecue that we never got to open. It is from Spain, from Ribera del Douro. The wine maker is Balbes. It is a Reserva from 2006, and it goes for just under $24. And this is a really good wine. And also, it's cool when you can find wines that are 13 years old, which, I mean, it's classic Spain. You know, they don't release anything early. And this is, you know, it's under $25. And I'll quickly go through it. I made a couple little notes before I hit record on this because there's nothing worse than when the person is just struggling to figure out, you know, the fruit content and what's going on the, you know, what the acid is. So on the nose, dried fruit, balsamic. This wine, though, the first thing you're going to get, it's a classic Ribera del Douro. Like, this is your stereotype. This is American oak. So there is vanilla and there is coconut. It's there. It's easy to figure out. You know, I'd like to give you some sort of like hipster notes and go off of it, but I'm not going to do that. There's vanilla. There's coconut. And I'm not saying there's a bad thing. I mean, that's just part of it. I mean, this area is known for doing this, whether it's French oak, which you're not going to get this, but you're also going to get a lot of American oak. And this screams, you know, some American oak. This is an oak-influenced wine. I'm not sure. I haven't checked, but I'm just going to go with that this is American oak. I'll check my notes. Maybe in the middle of my tasting notes for this, I'll be proven wrong. So beyond the vanilla and some coconut, dried fruit, it's led with more dark fruit notes, plummy. And I wonder if the plummy is because this wine is 90% Tempranillo and 10% Cabernet Sauvignon, which is becoming more commonplace now. But back in the early 2000s or late 90s, you didn't see as much. The wine also smells a little hot. You can kind of smell the alcohol in this, but I don't mean in a bad way. It's 15%, but you know, just you can sort of sense it's there. On the palate, it's full bodied, but it's mellow. It's both big but mellow, which is nice. It's good finish. And what I like about this wine is the acid is there to combat against the 15% alcohol. You could worry, oh, it's just going to be this big wine that's going to be overwhelming. But there is a freshness on the end of it. So good acid there. And there's more fruit on the taste, on the palate, than on the nose. Some smoky, some chocolate. It's a lovely wine. Again, you got to be okay with the American oak influence. So a couple thoughts about Ribera del Douro, because it's very close to Rioja, like they're almost pretty much neighbors in, you know, northern Spain. And their wines, even though it's the same grape, it's basically Tempranillo, but they use a different clone. They use a thicker skinned version because they have more extreme weather. And this helps to produce darker, a little bit richer wines. The key to this area, which, by the way, this appellation or the DO was created in 1982 when there was just like 24 bodegas. By the end of 05, there was over 215. It's now 2019. And I would say there's probably close to 300. Vegasilia is obviously the big one that everyone knows. They're like the Chateau Latour of Spain. These are high tannin, powerful black fruit, plum sort of wines. And the acidity comes from the altitude. It is high altitude area. So even though the days can be really hot, the nights gets cold because of the altitude, which allows for the acid and the freshness. In terms of aging, okay, I'll do this quick because a lot of people are listening. I already know this. On most Spanish wines, you're going to see Crianza, Reserva, Gran Reserva. And that just means how long the wine has been aged. So real quick, if you see Crianza, that means the wine must have aged for at least 2 years prior to release, including 1 year in oak. For Reserva, it must age for 3 years prior to release, including 1 year in oak. And Gran Reserva, minimum 2 years in oak, 3 years in bottle for a total of 5 years. Now, the funny thing about this is this wine has aged for 2 years, so 24 months. So they go well above it. And they actually say on the label that this has spent 24 months in French oak. So this one, actually, it's funny because I was saying off the top before, this smells American just because, you know, the vanilla and the coconut. But you do get that in French oak as well. And kind of my point about this, why I said off the top, I'm screaming American oak, is because you got to be careful. Your nose will sometimes take you into places it shouldn't go. I guess, you know, you can get a little bit more like green pepper and some other things with the American oak, but I was fooled. Like, I'll just be honest. I could have lied or re-edited this, but I was going, oh, American oak, but it's not. It's French. The one thing you can say is the oak influence is definitely a big part here. So again, you know, the major difference is between Rioja and Ribera del Douro, because the temperature is a little more extreme. They use a different grape. The clone is called Tinto Fino, darker, fuller bodied styles of wine. So that's one of the differences between Rioja and Ribera del Douro. Now, of course, this is a grand sweeping generalization, but it's just one thing to keep an eye on. Also, Ribera del Douro, of interest, no white wine. If it's there, it is going to be a red wine. I would absolutely recommend this. And for people that like New World, but you want to get out of your comfort zone, this is a great wine. You'll find this at the LCBO. I apologize for people listening outside of Ontario. My recommendation, go find yourself, you know, a 10-plus-year-old Ribera del Douro. You don't need to spend the extra for the Gran Reserva. You can get yourself a good Reserva. And it's just because it is big and there is a boldness there. And you do get a lot of the things you love about New World, Cabernet Sauvignon or Merlot, or hell, even some like Sonoma Pinot Noir. The alcohol is 15%. But as I said, this wine, they keep everything together. You know, it's a well-maintained, well-made wine. It doesn't go off the tracks. It's not going to overwhelm you. But it's big. It's got power to it. It's a pleasing wine. It's a nice mouthfeel. It's an enjoyable wine. You enjoy it with every sorts of different sort of meat. And again, if you're someone who likes a big, bold wine, I would highly, highly recommend this one. Again, especially, it's under $25. You know, this is good value. Anyway, that is it for me for yammering. Again, if you want to get hold of me, mcause56 on Twitter, on Instagram. I believe I'm Matthew Cause. Also, I'm on iHeartRadio now. And, of course, Stitcher, iTunes, Spotify. Tell your friends. The more reviews we get, the more people listening, it's going to be better for the pod. We're looking to bring on some sponsors somewhere down the road, hopefully sooner rather than later. But, you know, I suck at this sort of thing. I'm not very good at asking for stuff. You know, it's just really not part of what I'm about. Also, I want to give a quick shout out to FWM Wine, Beer, and Spirits. They're family owned. They represent family-owned independent producers of fine wine, beer, and spirits from around the world. They're one of the top wine agents in Ontario. Between them and Henry Appellum, they helped me set up for this next interview, the one you're going to hear. So I just wanted to give a shout-out to them. They do good work. They bring in quality wine to Ontario and to Canada. So without further ado, from Valpolicella, from Verona, one of... just a very important person, a very interesting guy, a very accomplished winemaker and wine personality, but he goes beyond that. His family's been in for ages. From the area, from Verona, here is Andrea Sartori.
The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And very excited, before a wine dinner, I am here with winemaker and also a very influential man in Verona, Andrea Sartori. Andrea, thank you very much for being part of the podcast.
Thank you guys for having me.
Yeah, I'm sorry that you're here. As we record, this is June 10th, game 5 of the Raptors. Everyone in the city's going nuts and it's raining like crazy. I guess for me, my favorite place to start is, I believe this company was started just before the turn of the 20th century. I was wondering if you'd tell everyone a little bit about the winery.
Yeah, my family started the wine business 120 years ago. Mm-hmm. Actually, everything started from a restaurant and a hotel. Great-grandfather Pietro was the owner of, in fact, San Pietro restaurants in Verona. And he bought Villa Maria, which is a 1700th century estate surrounded by vineyards. And when he bought the house, he found a small cellar that was mainly used by the previous family for home consumption.
Yeah.
And he had the great idea to use the wine to supply the restaurants. And that's how everything started.
Really?
Yeah.
It's amazing how just some giant grand company, how it starts is through the most innocent and not how you ever expect it to go. So some general questions, and I want to get more specific. What do you love about the wines of Verona? And I guess also for the listeners, what is your portfolio? Because I know you've expanded it recently.
Our portfolio is pretty much covering most of Veneto production. So we also do Soave, we do Pinot Grigio and Prosecco in the white wines. But our core business is still Valpolicella, Amarone, and Ripasso.
Mm-hmm. And well, let's start with... your love of those wines of Verona. What is it? What is it? And we'll start with the reds. What is it about the Valpolicella, the Corvina, the Rondiello grapes? What is it about that you love?
I love those wines because they're friendly. Ernest Hemingway defined Valpolicella as the brother you get along with. That's how friendly it is. And I totally agree with that comment. They're friendly, they're smooth, they're elegant. You can match those wines with practically any food that you could possibly can think about.
Well, when I think of my background, I got into wine through the Cesari, Mara, and through those lines of wines. The Valpolicellos, the Ripassos, that's where the wines that I cut my teeth on growing up. And I still always say that the Cesari, or just a lot of Valpolicellos, they always represent great value for what you're getting in terms of quality. It's not nearly as expensive as, you know, say, your Barolos or Barbarescos out there.
I agree with you. And I think, generally speaking, Verona wines are over-delivering. And you can have a great experience without having to splash a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And again, they're so friendly. Sometimes I like to have my Amarone just with a cigar. And, you know, I call it pretty much like the wines for concentration,
yep.
where, you know, you sit down and you relax and you have a lot of thinking.
My stepdad the other day, we opened a 22-year-old Amarone. It was brilliant. Is it hard to pair with? Because one of the complaints sometimes you get with Amarone, especially young, is that, as you said, it is very concentrated, it's very big, and that can make it hard in terms of finding foods to pair it with.
I'm simple with that. My love for Amarone is with a good aged cheese, a beautiful piece of bread, and the importance here is the high quality of ingredients. And don't forget that Italian food is about simplicity. And that's why I think Amarone is so elegant that you don't need to get complicated with mm-hmm. food matching.
That's a good way of putting it. What are the biggest misconceptions of the white wines? I find, and it's not about Verona, it's more about the wines that get imported here, that a lot of times the Pinot Grigio sort of lacks the depth and character of, I imagine, the good stuff that we don't see as much here in Southern Ontario.
Unfortunately, yeah, I agree with you. I think I found in the market a lot of one-dimensional white wines from Italy.
Yeah.
I think the fact is coming from the way Italians drinks white wines, which is nearly as an aperitif, so they don't need any really complicated issues. They're just quaffable and simple, and maybe for that reason they've been very successful in many markets because they are that simple and direct.
Mm-hmm.
But definitely, I think we can do a better job in a certain area.
It's always been one of my complaints, and I have a love-hate with the LCBO. They do wonderful things. They're very important for Ontario, but if I had a complaint, I'd find that, unless I can find, like, the Germain, you know, Pinot Grigio, there's usually not a lot that has a lot of depth of character, and then it just seems like a very simple little bit of lemon-lime, some nice acidity, but there's really not much else going on.
The problem with monopolies market, and this is regard Scandinavian country as well, is that most of the time consumer doesn't have a total freedom to choose from the great variety and opportunities we have out there.
Yeah.
There are now, in Italy, at least 16,000 wineries, which has been officially recorded. And, I mean, not all of the wines can make it to this market. So mm-hmm. you have a limited access to some of the most beautiful production out there. And that is the only problem I find out with Monopoly. Elsewhere, they are very good. Their selections, anyway, is very good. And they do a great job to spread the culture of wine into the Canadians' consumers.
Well, I'd love to hear more. Just I want to talk about, you know, your role. You were a president for 2 terms for the Italian Confederation of Vine and Wine. Congrats for that. And I know you're still incredibly busy working in a very influential role. But how did you get into wine? What was it for you, Andrea, that when did you get that bug?
I got into wines not because of the products. I eventually then started to love the products too. Mm-hmm. But what I really liked it and what really got me into the wines was the wine people. When I was younger, my family was used to entertain home. So we have nearly every day some of the most incredible people coming to see us from many different countries. Our company exports 75% of the productions in about 70 different countries. And so I had really the pleasure and the opportunity to meet people from all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And the wine people is always very interesting, big character, sometimes big ego too. But I was totally fascinated by the wine people first, and then eventually I got fascinated by the products too.
Yeah, and you studied commerce at a university in Verona, and you also at New York's Columbia University. I was wondering if you could just talk to me a little bit about your journey from schooling and being in wine to eventually you were named president in 2000, was it?
In 2000, I became the president of the Sartori Company. And at the moment, I'm chairing the Consorzio della Valpolicella
mm-hmm.
and another consorzio, which is called Italia del Vino, which is a group of 21 wineries that got together to do promotion on the export markets. I like to be part of the wine community a lot and to share my experience with other wineries and trying to help all our community to progress.
Yeah. Was there a bottle that got you into it? And this is always a hard one because some people, they just, as you were kind of saying, you just grew into it, wine with your family. Some people have a specific bottle or a moment. Was there one bottle that really made you realize just how beautiful this product is?
Definitely Amarone. Mm-hmm. First of all, I'm a red wine drinker, but I got really fascinated by the character and the depth and the elegance of Amarone. And I'm very lucky because I travel a lot. So I have exposure to a lot of other wines from other countries. We gave me the opportunity really to be, I guess, different from other Italian producers that don't travel that much and they don't understand what's going on around the different productions countries. So I'm very lucky. I consider myself very lucky. I love Australian wines. I love American wines. I love some of the French wines. So I'm very open. I like Chilean wines.
Yep.
And of course, I love wines from other parts of Italy as well. So I'm very lucky. I consider myself very lucky because it has been a great experience to have the opportunity to taste other countries' wine.
You know what? I have a whole bunch of questions. I never thought of this until now because you've been such an important part in the role of Italian wine, the administration of it, the marketing of it, the selling of it. So I'm curious about this. I always hear about how France and Italy always kind of have a little bit of a cold war between them when it comes to wine. I'd love to hear some stories or just what is the relationship right now between the two most important countries in the world when it comes to vino.
I think it's a bit of love and hate.
Yeah. Let's focus on the hate. We'll get to the love. The hate is always more fun.
The hate is always more fun, but is I think, to be honest, we gave a lot of hard time to the French in the last 25, 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
We must admit that back in the days, French wines were commanding, were absolutely controlling most of the markets. And our market share in most of the time was very tiny compared to the French.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happened from the 80s onwards has been amazing how we turned most of the market to be at least head-to-head. And sometimes we pass the French. The only market where they are still very strong and it seems like we are not getting there is the Asian market and specifically the Chinese market where the French controls 45% of the market share versus the Italian that controlling 6%. So there is always a good fight to get market share around there.
Yeah, actually, I'll talk about China because I saw, you know, just there was a recent release with you talking about trying to get more into that market. I'm going to do a wild generalization.
Mm-hmm.
You tell me if I'm wrong. That if French versus Italy, when it comes to wine, Italians are more opening and welcoming with their information and it will more helpful with their neighbors. With France, they're not going to help anyone, and they're much more secretive and not as trustful, especially from wineries from other countries. Is there any truth to that?
I think they are a bit conservative, especially since in some areas, we must admit they have a longer traditions, and that maybe is why they're a bit more closer in opening up. But we must also see that the newer generations are different because also a lot of French producers are traveling different markets, and I think they're opening up to being more friendly and more open to discuss, you know, business model.
Because I found like I've been to Barolo twice, I've been to Verona once, and Chianti, and just as a wine tourist, it was always easier to go into almost any winery, even some high-end ones in Barolo, knock on the door, like, yeah, come on in. But in Bordeaux, you got to make a 1,000 different reservations. And in Burgundy, they don't even want you knocking on their door. Like I found, just as a wine tourist, that was the biggest difference I found in Italy versus France.
I think it has to be seen because of the Italian personality. Italians are very open and very welcoming and very friendly, no matter where you come from. Probably one of the most welcoming countries worldwide. And that's why tourism is so popular there, because we like people. We like people coming to see us.
Yeah, it's. I remember one time everyone was out everyone's in the fields harvesting. And, you know, a woman had to be in her mid to late 70s, didn't speak a word of English, brought me and my girlfriend in, and then brought out this huge plate of meat and cheese, and then looked like milk crates filled with with wines from, you know, from the very simple stuff all the way to the first crew Barolo, and like we were blown away with the hospitality.
This is the way we do, and like I said, I remember my parents and my family entertaining people home, mm-hmm. and having all sorts of different people coming to eat with us, having lunch or dinner, and being treated just like family members.
Yeah.
And that was the way, and it's still the way.
So from 2004 to 2010, you were the president of, in the English translation, the Italian Confederation of Vine and Wine. I was wondering what were your daily roles, what were your duties there, and what were the hardest parts? Because, you know, I read that group that you were president of represented 60% of the Italian wine industry. That's a lot of different personalities with a lot of different competing goals.
That was one difficult part of the job, but let's be honest, the most difficult part of the job was having to deal with politicians all the time. Mm-hmm. My role was representing them at both European level and at the, of course, the Minister of Agriculture level. So I was spending most of my time in Rome, you know, having to deal with them and having to negotiate or trying to understand or asking for better strategies and so forth. And as you probably can imagine, having to deal with politicians altogether,
yeah,
it's hard. But having to deal with Italian politicians is particularly hard.
I don't know if you could give any specific stories, but I'd love to hear stories of just any politicians or moments where there were serious roadblocks they were being put up to things you were trying to get done.
The most frustrating part when you deal with Italian politicians and politics is that we change government like everybody else changes weather. And since we became a republic in 1947, we had 50 government plus.
So what?
Yeah, the bigger frustration is that it's hard to get something done because when you think you're getting there,
yeah,
then the government change and you have to start all over again with a new minister, a new team. And it's very frustrating because it's very hard to get things done for this reason. So that was the hardest part I had to deal with.
Where is Verona Wines right now, and your winery, you guys, on a global scale? Where do you fit in?
Italy altogether, compared to other countries, is still very fragmented. So the average size of Italian companies is still relatively small. The country is big.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, altogether, we share number one with the French all the time. So either we are number one or number two in terms of productions, in terms of grapes and wine productions. But the average company size is still very small compared to the rest of Europe, or let alone North America, where you have large corporations that
yeah.
are doing big volumes and big business.
I'd love to hear, when you took over president of your family, of the winery, started doing extensive research in partnership with the University of Verona, with the Department of Agriculture, €2 million spent on complete analysis of all your vineyard holdings. I was wondering, what did you find? What did you discover, I guess now 17 years ago? What did you start to discover back then, and what's changed from then to today?
What we did is, the exercise we did is called zonation. So basically, we wanted to find out what was going out there in terms of soil compositions, rainfall percentage, specific climate, zone it down by hectares in the whole area. And that's why it was a very expensive exercise, because
yeah.
we analyzed everything to consult then with farmer and telling them what was the right treatment, the right clones to plant in that specific lot and so forth. So that gave us an opportunity to improve our quality dramatically, because now with that exercise, we know exactly what has to be done out there. Of course, the climate has changed.
Yep, I want to get to that.
And that is a factor we have to consider, but the platform is still there. So the soil composition is still there. You know, the clones that we recommend because of the sun exposure, the number of hours they have of lights and so forth is all mapped out. So
yeah.
that hasn't changed. What has changed is, of course, the temperature and the rainfalls.
So before we get to climate change, this extensive research you did, the millions of euros you spent, how long did it take before you could see results in the wines themselves?
Well, it took us around 5 years to see things changing because nothing happens fast out there.
Yeah.
You have to consider, even when you plant new vineyards, you have to wait 3 years to have the first production. And when it comes down to Amarone, you have to wait 4 years. So nothing happens fast out there. So it takes time.
Let's talk about climate change. What is climate change? What has it meant to Verona?
Meant a lot because things have changed dramatically since 2003, which was the first really hot year. But we have seen that happening again, except 2014, that was a kind of cold and wet year. Everything else has been extremely hot during the summer. So we're taking a lot of different action. The first things we are doing is to move up vineyards on a higher altitude.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have to make sure now that water is out there, which is easier to say but not very easy to do.
Right.
We have to make sure that most of the farmers has water access. And then, of course, we are looking into the changing of timing when you do harvest. And we are recommending farmers to stick with the pergola system.
Mm-hmm.
Where you have the curtain of leaves protecting the bunch from the sun exposure.
Right.
And this is, we are recommending to stay with that system, which is still 75% of our vineyards.
Really? Okay. So, yeah, and for people listening, that just provides more shade, the pergola system. And it's one you don't see a lot. I don't see a lot here in Ontario. I was just in Rueda in Spain. I didn't see it there at all. What would you say to people that tell you that climate change isn't really a thing?
I always come back with a line I heard from one of David Letterman comedy.
Yep.
The global warming convention has been suspended because of a snowstorm. So is basically unpredictable.
Yeah.
Although, like I said, the pattern we have seen since 2003 is quite serious. And I don't see any indications that it's going away. So it's something we have to consider.
I was reading, when I was doing my research, I found an article from Wine Spectator about a 2017 ruling between yourself and these 13 members of the Amarone families. And I love this quote. You said, "I thought that after all those years working at the national level, the local consortium would be a piece of cake. Was I wrong?" I was wondering if you, I would love to hear the story that led to that quote.
Well, after 6 years having to deal with people from the Alps to the Sicilian islands, I thought I've seen it all.
Yeah.
I was totally wrong. I think there is much more, I would say, personality issues between people in the area sometimes. My predecessor, I think, got it into personal, so there was some friction, some rust that has stayed around. So it looks like it's very difficult to compose the things, much mm-hmm. more than I thought. And again, I thought having to deal with such a difference of culture during my 6 years at the Confederations would make this very easy, and I was totally wrong.
And what happened? Because I was just reading about there was a lawsuit between the Valpolicella Wine Consortium and these 13 members of the Amarone families, and some of them are well known here, like Tedeschi. We get that wine all the time. Massey, talked about with you. Tomasi, sure. Zanata. Like, these are some ones we know about, and they had to stop using Amarone to denote the name of a private group. And I'm curious, just what was it that they wanted, and what was the part that on your end that you found troublesome?
I must tell that most of them are very good friends. So we get together for other things in the wine politics.
Yeah.
So I have no personal issues with them. What we didn't like of them, they were using a name, Amarone, which belongs to the community, to do their own commercial promotions. Mm-hmm. And that is not permitted by law anyway. So we were kind of forced and asked by the Minister of Agriculture to take action, and that's what we did. So we asked them to take out the name Amarone from their communication and commercial communications.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, we had to go to court to get the issues done.
Why did they want that?
They wanted that because they felt that it was a very important part of their communications, which was, to me, unnecessary because it's obvious that they are family working in the area. So
yep.
I think it was an unnecessary use of a name which belongs to the community.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow, what I didn't like of their communications, they were suggesting that they were better than anybody else.
Right.
And to be honest, I don't like that. I think we all try to promote our wines in our communications, but it doesn't mean that we say the other are bad. Mm-hmm. That was their basically suggested line.
Right, yeah. And so, yeah, I could see why on your end you're going to be protective. There's 13 that think one thing. You're there to protect all the other winemakers who, you know, are not making mass market cheap Amarone, which I don't even know how you can make cheap Amarone. It's expensive to make.
Not only that, the consortium represent 80% of the production. So we have like 300 wineries that are members and more than 2,000 farmers. So whether anybody likes it or not, the consortium is the home.
Mm-hmm.
And is the representations both at political level and a technical level of the area. So that's where we are, and that's what we have to respect.
Before I want to talk about the wines we are going to try tonight, but the most controversial part of this interview, I've saved for the end. I couldn't believe this. I found somewhere that you are not a fan of the Rapasso technique, which is, when I think of Verona, I think part of me thinks of Rapasso, and you said you liken it to many cases to reusing a used tea bag, and I'm curious with you with Rapasso, your feelings about it.
Rapasso is a technique that was starting back in the days to improve the average quality of Valpolicella, and is a great wine technique. But I felt many times that was kind of shortcut.
Mm-hmm.
And I always, my dream is to make Valpolicella better without having to use a winemaking technology.
Yeah.
And I think it's possible. However, I can't deny that Rapasso became such a strong brand and such an important factor for our economy that I have to respect that.
Yeah. Well, I'll say this. Like when we try sometimes, not the Rapasso technique, but the Passamento here in Ontario, I find the results have been mixed at best, and that I'll try the wines and I can't tell what grape I'm drinking. I feel like I'm drinking the process. I'm not drinking the terroir or the grape, and that's a problem that I have. I mean, it's not about Rapasso necessarily, but it's about a Passamento, but it's still the idea of taking a grape and changing the fundamental nature just to create more power in your glass, which I'm against.
Yeah, I see where you're going, and I understand that for many people, wine technologies seems like a shortcut.
Oh, no, it has its place. It's very specific. When I'm drinking Ontario Pinot Noir, I want to drink the Pinot Noir. I find when they do the concentrating the grapes, it changes it. And it's not that it's not well made. It's that it's changing it to a different flavor that I don't recognize as much as what a Pinot Noir from Niagara should taste like.
Yeah, in that case, I believe that the appassimento done in the area, it's not changing much the personality. I wouldn't say the flavor profile. It's, of course, changing the personality of the wines, making it a much bigger product, but it doesn't change the flavor profile.
Yeah.
So appassimento, for me, it's not getting too far away from the original formula.
Oh, yeah. In Italy, it feels like to me Italy is where it should be done. In Ontario, it's stick to, what works. Andrea, what are we going to be drinking tonight? I'm excited.
Tonight, we are starting with a white wine, which is called Marani, in honor of my grandmother. It's 100% Garganega, mm-hmm. which is the main grapes in the Soave district. And it's a kind of white Amarone, if you like, because we dry the grapes.
Really?
Yeah, we dry the grapes to the end of November to have a more concentrated profile. And it's a very unique white wine, which is hard to believe is Italian. It's a white wine you can eventually age.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very, very different. I'm very proud of it. And also brings me back memories from my grandmother, which was my absolutely queen in the family.
Yeah.
After that, we're tasting the three wines we have produced to celebrate the 120th anniversary of the company.
And again, congratulations.
Thank you. And we're tasting the Valpolicella Superiore 2016 vintage, Valpolicella Ripasso 2015 vintage, and Amarone from 2012 vintage. And then I brought a wine from my library, which is a Corte Bras Single Vineyard Amarone 2003 vintage.
Oh.
To taste with people the first vintage that changed a lot of things for us.
That's going to be fantastic. Hey, thank you so much for taking the time, Andrea. I really appreciate it. Congrats again on all your success. And as I said before, the first wines that turned me into someone who loved wine were wines from Verona, from the Valpolicella area. So this is going to be a really special treat. Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you for having me, and please come to visit us in Italy.
I got to do is convince my girlfriend. I know we've been twice. What's wrong with a third trip? And I'll definitely be back. As I say to everyone, it's the easiest place to travel, you know, in terms of just the hospitality. You guys have always done it fantastically. Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and wherever good podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.